Penguin Random House Audio presents Pure Invention, How Japan's Pop Culture Conquered the World. This is the author, Matt Ault. For Jean Morden, who taught me the fundamentals of Japanese. In fact, the whole of Japan is pure invention. There is no such country. There are no such people. The Japanese people are, as I have said, simply a mode of style, an exquisite fancy of art. Oscar Wilde, The Decay of Lying, 1891. Introduction. A woman's face emerges from darkness. She kneels before a machine whose output bathes her angular features in an eerie green light. She rises and walks away, footfalls echoing on the pavement. A basket of flowers sways from the crook of one elbow, the only sign of organic life in this dark, mechanized place. As she moves from shadow into the light of a street lamp, a strange-looking car roars by, momentarily obscuring our view. The camera pulls back to reveal our heroine standing before a shuttered storefront, pedestrians hurrying past. Who is she waiting for? We barely have time to wonder as the camera pans up to reveal enormous neon signs and billboards, cryptic brand names looming over the cityscape. This is a consumer metropolis from the looks of it. But where? Is this Times Square? Downtown Tokyo? The camera pulls farther back, revealing more of a mysterious urban landscape that, it becomes obvious, is nowhere we have ever seen. Nowhere that has ever existed. We soar over rooftops, turrets, and machinery, all encircled by high walls marked with a mix of Arabic numerals and Asian calligraphy. A tense drumbeat swells as smokestacks belch into the midnight sky. This is less a city than a fortress, a literal military-industrial complex. The screen flares, and a title appears. Final Fantasy VII. The rising strains of a synthesizer, haunting, melancholic, hint at wonders to come. Final Fantasy VII was a video game, and when it debuted in 1997, the world had never seen anything like it. It was the latest installment in a popular and increasingly misnamed series, but previous Final Fantasy titles had been delivered in the standard, two-dimensional, squashed and flattened perspective of traditional video games. Final Fantasy VII was a different beast altogether. Though blocky and primitive by modern standards, it was fully rendered in three dimensions, a major technological feat for the era. Even more groundbreaking, it dared to presume something new, that a video game could have the dramatic pull of a Hollywood blockbuster. Rather than the usual twitch reflex fisticuffs and gun battles, Final Fantasy VII plunged players into the midst of a drama. Their role was one of a ragtag band of eco-terrorists, determined to stop a faceless corporation from sucking their planet dry of its lone energy source. We learn that the waiting woman is Eris, a flower peddler who turns rebel in the course of her quiet romance with the player character, a former soldier with the disarming name of Cloud. Final Fantasy VII presented gamers with a cast as well-developed as those from television shows or movies, and it followed them through an unpredictable, at times deeply moving, narrative. The game's dramatic peak, Eris's shocking, too-soon death, affected young players so profoundly that one modern critic has called it the moment when gaming culture stood still. Of course, the brave new world of Final Fantasy VII wasn't actually out of Hollywood at all. It was a Tokyo blockbuster, and it would inject a megadose of Japanese sensibilities into the American mainstream. Big-eyed, bushy-haired anime characters and their manga-style melodrama. Androgynous heroes. The very idea that video games could be meditative explorations as well as thrill rides. Sony's marketing team poured $30 million, unprecedented for a video game, into an all-out media blitz modeled on the campaigns for tentpole American films. They targeted young audiences with ads in Marvel and DC comic books. Adults with spots in Rolling Stone, Playboy, and Spin magazines. And everyone with slick commercials that aired in movie theaters, during football games, on MTV, even during Saturday Night Live. They said it couldn't be done in a major motion picture, teased one ad, taking aim at the establishment. They were right. Each commercial ended with a close-up of the PlayStation logo, with a young female voice robotically intoning the word as pronounced in Japanese, PlayStation. The previous best-selling PlayStation title, the British-made Tomb Raider, sold a very respectable 150,000 copies in the first quarter of 1997. Final Fantasy VII sold 1 million copies in the quarter after its September release. Players didn't seem to mind the game's rushed translation, with occasionally misspelled character names and meme-worthy moments like Aeris declaring of another character, "This guy are sick!" If anything, the garbled language only added to the game's exotic cachet, reinforcing the idea that it had emerged from a real-life technopolis, almost as alluring as the fictional setting of the game itself. Sales would eventually reach 13 million copies worldwide. In the late 1800s, right at the cusp of the 20th century, a new craze swept the Western world: Japanese-ime. Japan had reopened its ports only a few decades earlier. Tastemakers in England, France, and America pounced on its art and literature, projecting upon the nation values they believed their own societies had abandoned in the drive for industrial advancement. Japan was, quote, "a great and glorious country, whose people are brave beyond all measure, wise beyond all telling, amiable to excess, and extraordinarily considerate," in the opening lines of a picture book based on the smash hit 1885 Gilbert and Sullivan play, The Mikado. This was the enthusiastically condescending mindset Oscar Wilde invoked and subverted when he referred to Japan as pure invention. Japan as Western fantasy. The antique land, as the Victorians called it, would prove a compelling vision for many years. It would take World War II to derail it. After Japan's inglorious defeat in 1945, the nation's makers did their best to obscure the origins of the products they sold to the world. A decade later, notoriously gruff Secretary of State John Foster Dulles blithely informed Prime Minister Shigeru Yoshida that Japan should never expect to find a big market for its products in America because, quote, "Japanese don't produce the things that we want," end quote. He was even more condescending in private, telling a confidant that, quote, "suicide is not an illogical step for anyone concerned about Japan's economic future," end quote. Indeed, the first Japanese products that trickled into the global marketplace after World War II did inspire derision, not admiration. Made in Japan became a punchline, a synonym for cheapo crap from a defeated joke of a nation. $1 blouses. Tin toys made out of recycled cans. The flimsy paper umbrella in your tiki drink. Breakfast at Tiffany's laid the post-war relationship bare, with Mickey Rooney yellow-facing as the bumbling, bucktooth, kimono-clad Yuni-oshi, positioned as the pathetic antithesis to Audrey Hepburn's sexy, all-American social striver, Holly Golightly. Yet things were already changing. In the winter of 1957, just 3 years after Dulles's pronouncement, a certain pocket-sized transistor radio steamrolled the competition to become the nation's must-have Christmas item. The colorful TR-63 was the first product to bear the logo of Sony, a name chosen for its culturally ambiguous sound. The TR-63 seemed just another holiday fad, but the way it upended American expectations of what Japanese products could do was merely a taste of things to come. The steady drip of 60s novelties turned into a flood of high-quality consumer electronics and cars in the late 70s and early 80s. Suddenly,
sample complete. Ready to continue?